Karen Smith here, and welcome to Lesson 28. Today we're going to be looking at the six team dysfunctions. Now, doesn't that sound sexy and exciting? Well, not yet, perhaps. But in these next two lessons, because we're going to be dealing with the team dysfunctions and how to make teams excitingly functional, in these next two lessons. And in this time, we're going to discover how to create some of the most exciting, challenging, difficult, and fulfilling moments in your team's evolution. Plus, this will give you a blueprint for creating the kind of teamwork and outcomes that will enable your NGO to make a massive difference. But don't just take my word for it. Let's dive in and get going, so that by the end of these next two lessons, you can decide where you want to take this new knowledge, which tools of these that we're going to go over you want to use, which levers you're going to want to pull. Plus, you're going to see that also you don't have to do it all perfectly to begin to make some magnificent changes, many of which you just won't want to give up. So let's get going. So what are we going to cover? First, we're going to look at why take the time to make teams work. We're going to look at what I call the dysfunction of positioning. We're going to then look at Patrick Lencioni's five dysfunctions of a team, and he did a brilliant job in this book, and I would strongly advise you to get this book and to read it in its entirety. But we're going to be looking at those dysfunctions in this and tomorrow's lessons. To give you some context for this lesson, I can't think of a better way to start the lesson than by reading something from the introduction of Patrick Lencioni's book, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, A Leadership Fable. So let me just take the first page and a couple of lines. Not finance, not strategy, not technology, it is teamwork that remains the ultimate competitive advantage, both because it is so powerful and so rare. A friend of mine, the founder of a company that grew to $1 billion in annual revenue, best expressed the power of teamwork when he once told me, "If you could get all the people in an organization rowing in the same direction, you could dominate any industry, in any market, against any competition, at any time." Whenever I repeat this adage to a group of leaders, they immediately nod their heads, but in a desperate sort of way. They seem to grasp the truth of it, while simultaneously surrendering to the impossibility of actually making it happen. And that is where the rarity of teamwork comes into play. For all the attention that it has received over the years from scholars, coaches, teachers, the media, teamwork is as elusive as it ever has been within most organizations. And the fact remains that teams, because they are made up of imperfect human beings, are inherently dysfunctional. But that is not to say that teamwork is doomed. Far from it. In fact, building a strong team is both possible and remarkably simple, but it is painfully difficult. That's right. Like so many other aspects of life, teamwork comes down to mastering a set of behaviors that are at once theoretically uncomplicated, but extremely difficult to put into practice day after day. Success comes only for those groups that overcome the all-too-human behavioral tendencies that corrupt teams and breed dysfunctional politics within them. As it turns out, these principles apply to more than just teamwork. In fact, I stumbled upon them somewhat by accident in my pursuit of a theory about leadership. So Patrick makes it fairly clear from this little excerpt that while in principle this work of creating fantastic teams is simple, the actual work itself is not so easy. However, I don't want you to focus on the challenges or the difficulty that you might face as you work on building a team that is able to make significant change. What I do want you to focus on is why you're doing it, and what it is that you want to achieve. And to help you do that, I want to start with the first dysfunction, which is outside of the loop of Patrick Lencioni's dysfunctions of a team. But this is a dysfunction of attitude, or a dysfunction of backward positioning. Let's take a look at this. So what do I mean by backward positioning? Let me try to explain this by a virtual little Simon Says. And so I'm going to begin with Simon saying, look over your left shoulder, right shoulder, it doesn't really matter. But what I want you to do is to kind of twist and turn and look back and look down. And I want you to notice what happens with your breathing. Now I want you to, in your chair still or wherever you are, I want you to look up physically so that your head tilts up, your eyes tilt up. And what do you notice about your breathing? Now, this is just a very simple example that you can feel in your body. When you look back and down, you exhale. When you look forward and up, the natural movement means that you inhale, you oxygenate. And this is only acknowledging the most obvious of the bodily components of this shift. If we were to do more exercises like this and were to get you to be more aware of your feeling, your emotions that go with those two, I believe that you would begin to notice that looking back and down is more of a downer and looking up and forward is more uplifting. But more than that, what I'm really also addressing here is your focus, your internal focus, or what your mind and internal eye is focusing on. And as you know, where your focus goes, so your energy flows. To expand this a little further, I'm juxtaposing problem justification against solutions exploration. One is looking backward and tending to be down in terms of looking at analyzing a problem. The other one that is looking more forward and upward in an exploratory attitude. It's less certain than the problems. It requires a little bit more of a willingness to play with uncertainty, to enjoy and have the courage to go places where we haven't been before. This just expands upon and differentiates further the attitude or the backward positioning of somebody who always tends to pull up and bring into the conversation description of the problem, justification for why we took a certain position in the problem, the analysis of the problem, as distinct from spending the time exploring possible solutions. Why I am underscoring this concept of backward positioning is to give you a way to reposition yourself in any given moment, and that may be physiologically and psychologically, to a forward-looking or generative position. Let's do one more quick exercise. I want you to feel the difference and not just think about the difference. Sit down with your back curved, your chin on your chest, your eyes down. Sit with that for even 15 seconds. You don't have to do this right now, but you can while you're listening also. And then try to observe what goes on in your mind, not just your body, but your sense of things as you do that. And then, even if for no reason at all, you just sit up straight and put a big, big grin on your face. The physiological difference of taking those different positions impacts you. Your body is, after all, connected to your mental state. The two are not totally separated. While this may not be new to you, what I want you to notice is your capacity to make these simple changes and how they are in the end not really simplistic, but they are easy to do when you set your mind to it. Now, why is this important? Have you ever felt like you've reached a point where nothing that you do matters? How helpful is that? Or ever needed to shift your thinking from such a state but didn't know what to do? These little things change your physical position, change how you sit, change how your head is, change your attitude, the direction that you look or move, is something simple to do and can initiate a process of change. Then if you multiply these physiological changes with internal or cognitive shifts and readjustments, then you can make an even greater change. Now, these things are not the incantations that magically remove the problem. However, the knowledge of how to consciously choose a different attitude and position and the conviction of the value of baby steps can be very important, especially when you're seeking to make significant change. And if you have a team of people, not just one person, but a team of people who have that profound understanding that baby steps make quantum leaps possible, then there is nothing that that team cannot do in time. Now, obviously, more than a helpful attitude is needed to make your team wildly successful. However, checking your attitude and whether or not your team is problem-focused or solutions-focused will go a long way to getting your team on the right track. And that's why I wanted to lay this out first before we go on further into the other five dysfunctions of teams. So what are the five dysfunctions of teams that Patrick Lencioni speaks about? Well, first of all, he goes into the absence of trust and how trust is fundamental to all of the building of the expertise, the capacities of the team to function exceptionally. But we'll get into what he means by trust and the specific component of trust that he really looks at and accentuates in a moment. Next, he looks at the fear of conflict, then lack of commitment, and then building on or connected to this lack of commitment is the natural avoidance of accountability, and then on top of that, inattention to results. Now, to visually describe this, he uses a pyramid. And this is what I call at least the Lencioni model. So down the bottom he has is the fundamental concern, or the fundamental dysfunction is that of the absence of trust. When there is no trust, then the differences, the tensions that arise from different perspectives, different understanding, different beliefs, different knowledge, different experience base, different positions, all of those things, the tensions that arise out of that become more of an issue of conflict. And when there is a fear of facing those differences and see them as highly conflicting, then the team seizes up, does not communicate well. When there's a fear in that, they do not talk things out, rather they hide them away, and then those concerns that do not get talked out and dealt with in public just end up coming out later on through backdoor routes and undermines the effectiveness of the team. With this fear of conflict, then it's very difficult for the team to develop a common commitment. There is no clarity there. There is no common cooperation toward that commitment. And then, of course, connected to that, or on top of that, is there is no accountability. When there's no common commitment, then what people are working toward and valuing is all over the place. And so then there is no chance of there being a accountability to one another for a common set of outcomes. And so without this accountability to one another and to the larger purpose, then there is an inattention to results and a justification for why the work doesn't get done. So that's very briefly the Lencioni model, but let's go into it a little bit more in depth. Beginning with the definition of trust that he uses in the context of team building. But what Lencioni focuses on here is trust is the confidence among team members that their peers' intentions are good and that there is no reason to be protective or careful around the group. Just a quick note, here we're talking about the idea of a true team. That is a team that is called upon to construct and to generate and to work together to develop outcomes, to develop solutions, to create or construct or to produce outcomes together. Not just to independently work and then to add all of their outcomes together, but that the team as a whole is tasked with certain outcomes. Now, here, the trust does not mean that everybody has to be of the same capacity level, or that they have the same knowledge base, or that they have the same perspective. But in fact, what Lencioni indicates here is that trust is essentially the confidence that the peers' intentions are good. And so when differences, when misunderstandings arise and even cause some kind of conflict, that the fundamental belief in the other's intent can override any of the other concerns that do and will arise. And so therefore, the team members can allow themselves to be vulnerable around the group. Now, you can't just walk into the room and expect a group of people to expose their vulnerabilities. There has to be an environment, a working together that builds these levels of trust. This underscores the need to invest in the team as a working, producing group. So next, what we're going to do is look at what dysfunctional teams do, followed by what highly functional teams actually do, and then look at some exercises that can be done to overcome the dysfunction and build trust. Members of teams with an absence of trust will usually conceal their weaknesses. They'll hesitate to ask for help from one another. They'll hesitate, in fact, to offer their help to one another. And they'll jump to conclusions about the intentions and the aptitudes of others. With an absence of trust also, they continue to fail to recognize and tap into one another's skills and experiences. They waste time and energy managing their behaviors for effect and usually for some political end. And they hold grudges. They dread meetings and find reasons to avoid spending time together. So whenever you see these kinds of behaviors, you're looking at a group of people that may call themselves a team, but sadly are wasting so many of the human resources that make up that team, and the potential of what that team could be doing if only they would adjust some of their behaviors and begin with a foundation of trust. On the other hand, members of trusting teams are able to admit to one another their weaknesses and their mistakes. They're able to ask one another for help, to accept questions and input about their own areas of responsibility, and not just to feel threatened by that. And they give one another the benefit of the doubt before arriving at negative conclusions. Members of trusting teams take risks in offering feedback and assistance. They appreciate and tap into one another's skills and experiences. And they focus time and energy on the important issues and not on managing the politics of the group. They offer and accept apologies without hesitation, and they look forward to meetings and other opportunities to work as a group. So by articulating each of these dysfunctions, it actually allows us to see what a highly functioning team needs. Now, if you stop and think about what gets lost when these kinds of capacities are not built into the team, so much time is lost. in fact, the whole purpose of the team, if not the whole, but a large purpose of the team, is simply undermined by these dysfunctions. But there are things that can be done to overcome these dysfunctions. And some of these, while they don't get done overnight, this trust is not built quickly. It can be done. And when the work is important enough to spend the time to build the trust, then that's what needs to be done. There are tools for building trust in teams, and these are some of them. Doing personal histories exercises, team effectiveness exercises, personality and behavioral preferences. For example, the Myers-Briggs type indicator. That's an index that gives some indication of the affective characteristics of an individual. And then there's like the Kolbe test that deals with conation and the more willful determination to act according to the instinctive predispositions of an individual. And any of these allow the team members to understand the differences in personality, in ways people go about doing things, in how decisions are made, in where people get their energy from in order to go out and be effective in the world. And just to realize that with all of those differences, the group can end up stronger because of those differences. Rather than seeing differences as weaknesses, you can see how they weave together to form a very potentially a very powerful and effective team. Investing in some of these tests for your team members can be not only an investment in their own self-awareness and understanding, but very much in the development of trust in the team. You could also use the 360 degrees feedback tool. Decide to utilize some or all or bits and pieces of many of these types of tools that help build trust in teams. The personality and behavioral preference profiles are some of the most effective and lasting tools for building trust on teams. They help break down barriers by allowing people to simply better understand and empathize with one another. Now, another one that has somewhat dropped out of favor, but is still has its place so long as it's being done on a foundation of some of these other tools, is the experiential team exercise, where people go out into and do some kind of very challenging, physically challenging activity together. But that's just another one that you can put into your toolkit for building trust in teams. Now, a very important one is the role of the leader. The leader really does need to take the initiative in exposing themselves as being vulnerable, in allowing themselves to be vulnerable to the others, in not just holding all of their limitations and quote-unquote weaknesses to be hidden behind the veneer of the position. The reality is, people see our weaknesses and our strengths anyway. It's not like they don't exist. But it's important that the leader be prepared to initiate the process of choosing to expose their weaknesses and, very simply, to appreciate the strengths and to be able to find ways to utilize and connect with the strengths of others, valuing each one in turn, and especially seeing and helping show that the strength of the team is in the meshing of the strengths and the supporting of one another's weaknesses. Just before we wrap up this lesson, I'm going to point out the connection to the second dysfunction that this element of trust plays. Trust is needed to be able to engage in passionate and sometimes emotional debate, knowing that they will not be punished for saying something that might otherwise be interpreted as destructive or critical. In order to develop and to go to new places as a team in thought, in idea, in proposed work, we have to be able to explore and to probe and to make recommendations that aren't the best in order to sift through and end up developing the very finest response and recommendations. So the point is here, mistakes are not wrong. They're not sins. They're not crimes. But oftentimes, without the foundation of trust, people will not expose their thoughts, their insights, nor will they take the chance of exposing themselves to ridicule unless they really can trust that the intent of the other is in everyone's best interest. Trust is needed to be able to engage in passionate and emotional debate. And in the end, that's the only way that we're going to sort out and figure out the solutions to some of the world's most difficult and challenging problems. With that, I look forward to seeing you tomorrow as we continue with looking at these dysfunctions and continue to look for what is needed and how to go about building a superlative functioning team.